from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're lucky, summer comes with a great book, or two, or three, or a whole bagful to stretch the mind, delight the heart, set it racing. We've got options for you. This hour, On Point, Great Summer Reads 2014. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you looking for this summer in a book? A bunch of books. Maybe we can help you out. What have you already found? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got three wonderful readers with us today. They've each given us their top 10 picks for the summer, and you can see those in full at our website, onpointradio.org. With us from Houston, Texas, Maggie Galehouse, book critic for the Houston Chronicle. She writes at the blog called Bookish. Maggie Galehouse, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Wonderful to have you. From Iowa City, Iowa, Paul Ingram joins us, book buyer for Prairie Lights Bookstore, where he's been picking what goes on the shelves there for 25 years. Paul, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And from New York is Peril Sagal, book editor for the New York Times Book Review. Peril Sagal, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Maggie, is there a theme this year? I see some common denominators across all of your lists with your fellow guests today, but is there a theme to the summer's harvest?
I don't know. I mean, you know, for summer, I tend to look for a few things. I tend to look for short stories because those are things you can read and finish and feel as if you've accomplished something mm-hmm. on the beach. And I look for humor. So that's my theme. I can't speak for everybody else.
Short and funny. I don't know. I like to get lost sometimes deep in the pages. Paul, what are you hearing people coming into the bookstore, Prairie Lights, asking for, looking for? They're saying, Paul, I need something kind of like what?
Well, surprising number of them are looking for something big and difficult. This is a university town, you know.
Of course.
These people are going to read one book for the summer. And they frequently know what they want or know what has been successful for them before. And I give them something that may or may not fill that bill, but and then some people just don't want anything bad to happen in the book.
there is that. That is a tall order these days, Peril.
Tall order in life,
you know? In life, no kidding, Peril. Big and difficult. They want it in Iowa City. If a reader came to you this summer looking for something, and let's say they've already done Ulysses or don't quite have the spine for that this summer, what would you recommend, Peril?
Oh, I'd go for the Nausgard, which I almost make fun of. It's so huge. You know, it's the guy's 40 and he's doing 6,000-page volumes of memoir, and it is the hottest thing going.
What is it called, and who wrote it? What?
It's called My Struggle, which is a little bit like Mein Kampf, and it's a memoir. It's an autobiography. He seems to be doing not hour by hour, but maybe fortnight by fortnight of his entire life. I'm not reading that.
And
I'm not even going
near
that.
Karl Ove Knausgård. That's with a K-N-A-U-S. What is that? Is that the Norwegian?
It's Norwegian, yeah, and he's being interviewed commonly now in the fancy newspapers that have like the LA Review of Books just did a really huge deal about him.
Janet Maslin called this the Proustian Norwegian literary event of the season. That truly sounds in volume three. Now, that sounds big and difficult. So there is that one. Paul, stand by. You've got a Paul and a Parul this hour. So it's a little tricky to keep them apart. Parul, how about you? If it's big and difficult or weighty, where would you point readers this summer?
One book I'm thinking of is Song of the Shank by Jeffrey Renard Allen. And we're reviewing him on the cover of the Times Book Review this coming week, and I recommend him to anybody who loves Toni Morrison, Michael Ondaatje. If you want a big, capacious novel that's, you know, transportive, that has very lyrical, lush language, that takes you back into American history. This is the one for you. It's the story of a 19th century slave who's blind and autistic, but also a musical prodigy, and he went on to play the piano at the White House, and he had this very long, incredibly complicated life. And what Allen has done is to sort of fill in missing parts of history while at the same time creating a reading experience that really draws on your senses and really gives you the sense of how this particular man experienced the world.
Based on the true story of blind Tom, a.k.a. Tom Wiggins, do you have
a little bit
you could read from Song of the Shank by Jeffrey Bernard Allen?
I do. And this is a scene when his guardian, he was sort of taken care of by this white woman. He was recently enslaved, is listening to him play the piano. And it goes like this. The windows glitter with faint fluorescent shapes, lines of fading sunlight shimmering on the walls like red strings of a guitar. The piano holds the sunset's color. She hears light drumming on the keys now like shells rattling in a boiling pot. Thousands of tiny, tinkling, hollow echoes. The boats seem to move in time to the music at the mercy of the rise and fall of Tom's hands. They continue their forward advance, moving farther and farther away. She listens, with inward breath, to the way he pushes deeper into the keys, so many notes overlapping in this room. No note ever sounds alone.
Yeah, it's beautiful. From Song,
you can give a sense of the sense of the music and the prose.
I couldn't agree with you more about this book. It's an amazing piece. I loved it all the way through. I'm glad you're reviewing it.
Yeah, and it's a difficult book too, which I think, you know, what you mentioned, like people want challenges, and this is, it's a very demanding book to read in certain ways, both the content and the style.
Maggie, you offer one that takes us back to a difficult book, though it is not the book itself. You've got one on your shortlist, the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, what, the story of a dangerous, difficult book and its emergence, Maggie.
Yes, I do. Although, you know, the title, The Most Dangerous Book, I mean, you know, this sort of speaks to the difficulty Joyce had getting this book, not just published, but sort of past censors and out into the reading public. But it's a very nicely written book by Kevin Birmingham. It follows the sort of legal and cultural battle, you know, to keep this book, which was once condemned as obscene, lewd, and lascivious by the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, you know, to try to keep this book
the same
out.
New York that published 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
But it's a very lively, well-written story. And I think that what it is for readers, even if you don't, even if you've just read, you know, Dubliners, which I think is the most accessible, Joyce, when Dubliners celebrated its 100th anniversary yesterday. But even for that, you know, it's about what it takes to get a book into people's hands. And it's something for, I think, young readers and writers that they could take something away from. It takes a village. It takes a lot of other writers who have clout and, you know, who have sway in certain circles. You know, and in the end, the obscenity trial ruled in Joyce's favor. The judge ruled that the book was not obscene, that there was an aesthetic value in its effort to record life as it is lived. That's, you know, there are lewd and lascivious parts, but the art sort of trumped them. And, you know, it's sort of a victory for all writers. And that book just came out days ago. So, it's a lovely book. I highly recommend it.
Paul, you take us far to the other end of the planet, you might say, in a book called Euphoria, among your picks. This is what Papua New Guinea and Margaret Mead set the stage for us. Euphoria by Lily King, Paul.
Yeah. Well, she changes the names of the people, of course. No one is called Margaret Mead. And I was going nuts trying to remember who she meant by Andrew Bankson, and I finally figured out it's Gregory Bateson, who is an also a very famous anthropologist. And it's about three anthropologists who get together in New Guinea, which is as different from any environment as most of us would like to explore. And it's about a love triangle. It's a lot of sex in this book. The Margaret Mead had a well-known passionate affair with Gregory Bateson, and she's there with her husband as well. And they're all trying to work together, trying to do some of the most interesting anthropological work that's been done in this century, which is thrilling just to listen to, just to listen to them talk. And these are some of the very last of the so-called primitive cultures. And she's a very, very good writer. And it's a pretty short book. She gets an enormous amount of material into her 250 pages, and it makes you want to read Margaret Mead again.
Yeah,
for one thing.
Yeah, anthropologist gone a little wild in Papua New Guinea. Does that satisfy your Iowa City? It may not be big and difficult, but do you get your highbrow plus earthy there with all your Saxon New Guinea, Paul?
All kinds of people like this. I mean, they love it because it's a great love story, and they love it because it's a very strange piece of life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hot books, great summer reads for your lazy days, warm nights on the porch, wherever you like to pick up that summer book. Of course, today, June 16th, Bloom's Day. Start off celebrations of James Joyce's Ulysses. We had fans cycling around Dublin in Edwardian dress with their bicycle bells ringing. It may not be Ulysses you pick up, but it might be the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses by Kevin Birmingham. It's on Maggie Galehouse's Top 10 for the summer. Book critic for the Houston Chronicle joins us from Houston, Texas this hour. Parul Sehgal is with us, book editor at the New York Times Book Review, with us from New York today. And Paul Ingram is here, book buyer for Prairie Lights Bookstore, finalist for Publishers Weekly Bookseller of the Year Award there in Iowa City, Iowa. Paul, you've got a book out of set in Little Rock, Arkansas, I think, and I wonder if you might tell us about it and read a little bit for us from A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip. That phrase alone brings back a certain long-ago classroom experience to me. What is it, Paul?
It's a memoir of the seventh grade by a tremendous novelist who is not well-known, named Kevin Brockmeyer. Most of his novels are a little postmodern. This is not postmodern, except that he refers to the main character as Kevin, you know, using third person. Mm-hmm. So it has a novel feel with it. And, you know, he's 12, and like most 12-year-olds, is terrified and doesn't know what's expected of him. He doesn't know at the beginning, early on, that he's gay yet. And somehow all the homophobic jocks around seem to have better gaydar than he does, because he doesn't know anything about that.
This is back in the time of Levi's, Izod's, and bomber jackets, he says. Read for us, Paul.
Okay. The high school is all noise and unrest, as different as can be from the church-like hush of the elementary school. Between periods, the building fills with people, shouting and running and flicking each other's knuckles with pencils, with choir kids singing, photographers snapping pictures, drill teamers cocking their hips, with couples bending hard into each other's bodies. In class, they all become the quietest possible versions of themselves. But in the hallways, everyone is either a swerver or a strider. The swervers... move this way and that, leaning and swaying like tops, taking the quickest route possible through the obstacle course of other people's bodies, while the striders choose a single path and follow it like a marble rolling down a chute. Kevin is a born swerver. He likes the sensation of bobbing beneath someone's upraised arm, slipping sideways past a big clump of juniors and seniors, that wonderful feeling of swiftness and intangibility. No one can catch him. No one can touch him. He could be a ghost running through a brick wall, a motocross racer, almost anything.
There's a little Leopold Bloom somehow in Kevin Brockmeyer's A Few Seconds of Radiant Filmstrip.
He remembers everything and something about the marvel of that. And it's like I went to my old high school not long ago, and the smell of it immediately took me aback, and I felt like I needed to get out of there. And you don't feel like you want to get out of Kevin's book because you can always close it.
But terrific. It's,
he's a tremendous, tremendous writer, and this is a very funny and very sad memoir.
A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip. Parul, you've got one on your list that brushes up against that sort of Catcher in the Rye era, but from a different angle and ends up on a different vector. Joanna Rekoff's My Salinger Year, as in J.D. Salinger.
As in J.D.,
tell us about
it. It's a very charming memoir of and a sort of portrait of publishing. Joanna Rekoff in the 90s started working at this fading publishing firm, and she was that was notable for representing J.D. Salinger. I'm sorry, it's a literary agency. Yeah. And so while she was there, she had to do everything from responding to, you know, his letters from his crazed fans to talking to him on the phone. And it's really lovely, gem-like look at both, you know, the literary aspirant. And especially because she's going to recall, for people who read this, Franny Glass herself. You know, she's ambitious, but she's shy and she's thwarted. And, just a lovely book about ambition, about falling in love with literature, about falling in love with Salinger's work. So I would recommend this to anybody looking for a little slice of New York literary life.
And it's a correspondence with the hermit himself?
I think she speaks to him on the phone a few times, and he comes in once, and he's, you know, very sweet and shabby. And but she doesn't have a huge, you know, it isn't really just about him. It's more sort of his work and sort of her desires to write and her desires to sort of understand and parse literary celebrity and elusiveness.
The publishing life there, and a little brush with J.D. Salinger in My Salinger Year by Joanna Rekoff. Maggie Gyllenhaal, one that is on all three of your lists, is, of all things, a very intimate account of dealing with death, in this case, of Roz Chast's parents.
Yes.
We know her from her work in The New Yorker. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And I can imagine listeners thinking, are you kidding me? On a summer reading list? What is so compelling about this account that you think that might have put it on all three of your lists, Maggie?
Well, I mean, if you've grown up reading The New Yorker, you know Roz Chast's cartoons. They're just kind of people who look maybe a little lumpy sitting on sofas with doilies on the, you know, on the edges and on the back. And we know her. And I think she's very honest. I think what's great about this, it's mixed medium. I mean, she draws this memoir about the final years of her parents, Elizabeth and George. She was an only child, grew up in Brooklyn. They stayed in the same apartment where she grew up until they were in their 90s, and she ended up having to put them in assisted living, and she could not wait to get out of there. And she's very honest and very funny about it. She was just like, eat my dust, I'm gone. But she loved her
parents. She feels very guilty.
She does. She feels guilty, but you know, it's a real, I think it's just funny and sweet. And I think one of the most touching moments is when her father goes first and then her mother dies. And then in the book, you have just 10 pages of sketches of her mother in bed in her final days. She didn't know what else to do, so she drew. And it's just lovely. And there's also, of course, pictures of all the junk that was in their apartment accumulated for, I don't know, 60 years. And, you know, every one of us can relate on some level. We're either on that train or or about to get on that train.
You've got a little reading here, her mother, kind of at death's door, what has been in a hospice. And could you read for us?
Yeah, she's supposed to be on her last legs. And, you know, when you're dealing, I think, with a parent, you're trying to reconcile yourself to the end. And so she goes to see her mother in the home where she's living. And here's the quote. A couple of weeks into the around-the-clock care, hospice, etc., I went to see my mother at the place, filled with dread, fearing the worst. Instead, she was sitting on the couch with one of the private nurses, a middle-aged woman from Jamaica named Goody. She was fully dressed. She was wearing shoes. She was eating a tuna sandwich. I knew that her retreat from the abyss should have filled me with joy, or at least relief. However, what I felt when I saw her was closer to, where in the five stages of death is eat tuna sandwich? So,
from Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant by Roz Chest. Parul, it made your list as well. Why do you think all three of you responded so to this one?
I think there's something going on with the graphic memoir that's its ability to mix terror and wit. I mean, we think about books like Fun Home, even Mouse. And this book just does
those
it.
Are it's gorgeous just, books, yeah.
That's right. And this book is so, it's so frightening and it's so sad and it's so funny. And there's something about her style too, right, that just lends itself to this subject. Like, you know, she's known for being like the great poet of anxiety in her subjects, right? Those lumpy figures always seem to be kind of vibrating off the page. And, you know, given this, right, the nearness of death and this sort of responsibility, it just, it comes together in this way that feels just perfect. And it is also just so tender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A generation of boomers is now in that position.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
So there's a lot of common interest here and a wonderful treatment. Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant by Roz Chast. Parul Segal, Paul Ingram, Maggie Galehouse, please stand by. Lots of listeners calling in. Ulysses, no less, calling from Pageland, South Carolina.
Can't wait to hear from him.
Okay. Ulysses, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Deep book.
Yes.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Can you hear me?
Hey.
Yes, loud and clear.
How's it going, sir?
Very well. What do you like?
Well, my favorite book was The Circle by Ted Decker.
How do you spell Decker there? Ted Decker, like D-E...
D-E-K-K-E-R.
All right. What's it about? What is it? The Circle.
It was more of a cross between The Matrix meets Global Holocaust with bioterrorists.
Oh, happy summer. The Matrix meets Global Holocaust with bioterrorism. Is it science fiction? Is it thriller, Ulysses?
It was more of a thriller for me, and the reason being is that because the first five pages start off kind of dull, but it had enough of a twist in it to keep you still engaged. But once I got into the first and second books, because it all came into a trilogy, and I got into the first and second books, I started to realize that, oh my God, this is very intriguing. I got to keep on reading. And in fact, I got to several altercations with my wife over it because I was spending so much time reading the book and not paying attention to her.
Altercations with the wife over it. The Circle by Ted Decker. That's the kind of commitment we love to a book. I appreciate Ulysses. I appreciate your call. The Circle by Ted Decker. There, bioterrorism meets the Matrix. Let's get one more. Diana in Nashville, Tennessee. Diana, you're on.
Hi, it's so glad to be here.
I can just barely make you out. Are you on a roller coaster?
I pulled over, but a big truck just pulled up next to me, but they moved.
Great.
Sorry. I wanted to call in because I started a book group. It's called the Pursuit of Happiness Book Group. I thought it'd be really good for the summer. I guess Oprah has a book list for joy-seeking women.
Okay.
And so we're doing books from that. It's like there's memoirs, there's self-help, there's fiction. And we started with Mr. Ouida's Guide to Gardening by Carol Wallace. I thought a gardening memoir would be really good for June because it's gardening month.
And how's it working out, Mr. Ouida's Guide to Gardening?
It was good. It was interesting. I wasn't totally sure. I guess Mr. Ouida is a memoir about this woman who has breast cancer, and she develops a relationship with her partner. Like, it's just a platonic, philosophical kind of friendship. And he's one of those people who sort of has a gift for happiness. So I think the idea is that it's like sort of her journey with him and how he sort of opens up her heart.
Yeah, Mr. Ouida's Guide to Gardening by Carol Wall. Diana, thanks for the suggestion. You know, watch out for that Pursuit of Happiness stuff. We had Sandra Singh Lo on just a couple of weeks ago, and that got really messy for her when she went down that road in a blaze of glory. I don't know, Maggie, The Pursuit of Happiness Book Club. How's that work with your book list this summer?
Well, you know what I have? I have like the shortest book in the world on my list. And it's a little bit about happiness. It's about kindness. I don't know if everybody remembers George Saunders gave a convocation speech at Syracuse that went viral. And it's all about being kind, sort of living your life the right way. And I put this book on the list because there have been school shootings, and it seems like it's a good chance to talk about being kind and trying to live the right kind of life. And, you know, these sorts of books come out, you know, in the late spring or early summer for graduates. You know, a collection of Kurt Vonnegut's commencement speeches came out, and there's a Lean In for Graduates even now. So, I have a little passage here from the George Saunders, if you want me to read it.
Sure, let's hear it.
Okay, all right. So he's addressing a class of students at Syracuse University, and at some point he says, "Travel, get rich, get famous, innovate, lead, fall in love, make and lose fortunes, swim naked in wild jungle rivers, but as you do, to the extent that you can, err in the direction of kindness. Do those things that incline you toward the big questions and avoid the things that would reduce you and make you trivial. That luminous part of you that exists beyond personality, your soul, if you will, is as bright and shining as any that has ever been. Bright as Shakespeare's, bright as Gandhi's, bright as Mother Teresa's. Clear away everything that keeps you separate from this secret luminous place. Believe that it exists. Come to know it better. Nurture it. Share its fruits tirelessly."
There, you've got that commencement address sound.
Isn't that sweet? Yes. I love it.
Swim gorgeous. Naked in jungle rivers, kindly. They're from what? Congratulations, by the way. Some thoughts on kindness by George Saunders.
Yes.
Parul, on your list for the Pursuit of Happiness book club, what have you got? I don't think it's Norwegian Proustianism, or is it?
No, I'm on a very grim trip, I think, this summer. But one book I have that isn't really about happiness per se, but I think it's about, it's a book that makes me immensely happy to think about, and it's a book that makes me happy and excited about the possibilities of language and storytelling. And it's very weird. It's a book called The Bees, and there's been a lot of buzz about this, pardon the pun, but it's a book about, it's kind of like The Handmaid's Tale set in a hive. It's a book told from the point of view of a bee. And she's sort of a lowly sanitation worker doomed to sort of like the lower castes. And, you know, she's to collect the bodies of dead bees. But then, of course, she discovers, you know, in Cinderella fashion that she has this, you know, hidden power, and things get treacherous and interesting. But the reason I love it is that it's so audacious. And it's one of those books that reminds me that there are things that only fiction can do. Only fiction can put you in that kind of a perspective. And so quickly, so immediately, and so, you know, with such a feeling of immersion. And it's just, you know, a kind of book that lives and dies on this voice. And it succeeds. It's brilliantly strange and unsettling and really unlike anything I've read recently.
Is it political? Are they making parallels with what's going on in human society these days?
Absolutely.
Is it 1984 in a beehive? Or?
Yeah. It's a little bit of that. It's a little
Animal
bit of Margaret
Farm.
Atwood. Yeah, very much Animal Farm. But there is... there is threaded through it, I think, a sense of humor and a sense of like the author's own pleasure in getting away with this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great books, hot summer reads for 2014 with Parul Sehgal of the New York Times Book Review, Paul Ingram, book buyer for Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City, and Maggie Galehouse, book critic for the Houston Chronicle. What are you looking for? What have you found? And lots of interesting stuff here online. We've got Neil, who's reading Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. There's big and difficult for you, but very rewarding. We've got Jonathan says, "Hate going to the beach, but I'm finally going to read 100 Years of Solitude." Gabriel Garcia Marquez, of course, who died not long ago. Wonderful, wonderful book. Jonathan, I hope you love it. Leora, The Romanoff Sisters from Helen Rappaport. Judy, The Confederacy of Dunces, Wolf Hall, The Golem and the Genie she's in right now. I've got Mark, who says he's on a beach in Spain reading Midnight's Children by Rushdie, and we're not. Wonderful. Mark's got Grapes of Wrath. Our producer, Sam Gale Rosen, maybe he'll get into Ulysses, reminds us, speaking of beach reading, that two of the best and weirdest chapters in James Joyce's Ulysses take place on the beach. And as it's Bloomsday, we will remember that right here. Peril, give us a little bit from the bees. You were talking. This is Lalene Paul, takes us into the life of a hive, the mind of a what, sentient bee there. Would you read for us?
This is how the book begins. And this, I love the beginning because it gives you a sense of, you know, fiction's ability to disorient you also, because you don't know that this is going to be from the point of the bee yet. So here's how it starts. The cell squeezed her, and the air was hot and fetid. All the joints of her body burned from her frantic twisting against the walls. Her head was pressed into her chest, and her legs shot with cramp. But her struggles had worked. One wall felt weaker. She kicked out with all her strength and felt something crack and break. She forced and tore and bit until there was a jagged hole into fresher air beyond. She dragged her body through and fell out on the floor of an alien world. Static roared through her brain. Thunderous vibration shook the ground, and a thousand scents dazed her mind. All she could do was breathe, until gradually the vibration and static subsided and the scent evaporated into the air. Her rigid body unlocked, and she calmed as knowledge filled her mind. This was the arrivals hall, and she was a worker. Her kin was Flora, and her number 717.
Wow, that's pretty great. We are
in the hive.
That they might have cramps. That's a nice touch.
Yes. And how hard it's just hard to be born, you know, whatever creature you are, it's hard to become. So.
Oh, that's just fantastic. Paul, take us off in a different direction. One of your short list, you got 10 in full, but you've got the Swan Gondola. This is set, am I right, in Omaha, Nebraska. What's the story, Paul?
Okay, this is by one of my favorite writers, Timothy Shaffer, who is an Omaha writer the way Faulkner is a Mississippi writer.
Wonderful.
He has a deep historical connection to the area, and you'll learn so much. But in 1898, when there was the World's Fair in Chicago, there was also one in Omaha where they thought that if they can do it back east, we can do it out west.
But they lost the PR battle. We all know Chicago's World's Fair.
Right. Well, it turned out that the Omaha World's Fair was more like a state fair, with lots of rubes coming in from the country being ripped off by all kinds of hucksters and crooks. And it has you know, it's not the scholarly
not the white
place.
City of Chicago, though there was plenty of rubes and hucksters there as well.
And they argued that, in fact, this was that their city was whiter. Some stupid. It starts out with a couple of Nebraska sisters sitting out on their in their house, and they're Emmeline and Hester, known in the county as the Old Sisters Egan, took their coffee cowboy style. The grounds fried up in a pan to a bitter sludge, then stirred into china teacups of hot water. They had their afternoon shot, as they called it, at the kitchen table, sharing a slice of wet and heavy rum cake that gave them each a dizzy spell. The sisters were 68 and 72. The day had been as peaceful as they'd ever known. So peaceful they just commented on it. And so very, very quiet, had said Emmeline in her delicate, dreamy voice, drawing the words out, strumming her fingers through the air back and forth, like across the strings of a harp. "Learn to love it," said Hester, "because it's the racket of your grave." At the uttering of the word grave, the house fell dark. And what happens when the house fell dark is something has fallen on the house, and it is a hot air balloon.
Oh, boy.
And I immediately thought the last hot air balloon
that didn't come down was The Wizard of Oz. And I think immediately he's going in this direction. And the person who gets out of the balloon is not the Wizard of Oz, but he might be a character from the Wizard of Oz. His name is Ferret Scarrot, and he is a ventriloquist. He has a little dummy named Oscar and a crook, as most of the performers at the Omaha place were. And he fell down because that's the way I believe he was leaving the Omaha World's Fair.
Paul, we've got it in The Swan Gondola by Timothy Schaffers there. It sounds pretty terrific. Parul, you've got a couple that go to the sea here, one way and another. One, mm-hmm. The Deep by James Nestor. Another Great Day at Sea by Jeff Dyer. Tell us about those.
Well, I mean, I think... So the Nestor book is a book called... And I love it because, you know, if you're like me and you're going to be landlocked this summer, it's a way for you to have this incredible adventure. And especially if you're somebody who either has lost the habit of reading science or you never had a taste for it, this is the kind of book that really kindles your sense of wonder. And what Nestor does is he explores the human relationship with the sea by looking at people, for example, who participate in this insane sport called free diving, which has existed as long as we have. It's basically humans jumping into the sea hundreds and hundreds of feet below the surface of the sea, just subsisting on one breath. Mm. It's tremendously dangerous.
How deep can you go? Yeah.
Oh, it's terrifying. And they're pulled up unconscious and bleeding, but they just get addicted. So he looks at these people who've fallen in love with the sea and their own ability to either withstand it or be bested by it. Then he talks to people who swim with whales. He talks to people who've created their own submarines. And it's a book about, you know, falling in love with the ocean, but also how little we know about the ocean. You know, we have, you know, better maps of the moon and of Mars than we actually have of the sea. So it's tremendously exciting. There's some really beautiful science writing in it. And there's also, you know, a taste of adventure, a taste of risk. So that's something that, you know, not all of us can be on a beach in Spain reading Salman Rushdie.
Who's the author again?
James Nestor.
And how N-E-S-T-O-R.
About, yeah. Yes, it is. And how about Another Great Day at Sea while we're on the water?
While we're on the water. So Jeff Dyer is, of course, one of our most sort of unclassifiable, eccentric, irresistible writers. And he's written books like Zona, which is a scene-by-scene recreation of the Tarkovsky film. He's written a book about his inability to write a book that's out of sheer rage. And in this book, this tall, lanky, very unruly Englishman goes on board the aircraft carrier, and he spends 2 weeks there. And it is just... I mean, he's so out of place, and he loves it, and he sort of talks about the rituals. And this, you know, it's also from the perspective of this incredibly undisciplined person talking about discipline, talking about this little subculture he discovers. And the language is beautiful, and it's you know, classic Dyer if you are a fan of his sort of, you know, sensibility.
George Dyer, Another Great Day at Sea, and he's on board there, the USS George H.W. Bush. That's the same one that's just been sent to the shore off of Iraq, where things are getting so messy right now.
Jeff Dyer.
So sorry. Yeah. Rebecca in Turner Falls, Massachusetts. Rebecca, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I'm calling in about The Mosquito Hours by Melissa DiLorenzo. It's a brand new book.
The Mosquito Hours. Tell us about it. What's the plot?
So the plot is it's three generations of women in southeastern Massachusetts on the coast. And the idea about The Mosquito Hours is there's this time of day where it gets dusky and mosquitoes come out. So the women rush off to this covered porch, screened-in porch, where they... You know, they have to deal with their lives, these three generations of women. And it focuses mostly on Vivian and her two daughters in their 20s and kind of what they go through. But the thing about this book that's lovely is the language just really carries you through. It's really descriptive and lilting. And the dialogue that's there, it's not laden with dialogue. It's funny, it's humorous. And you love the characters. And one of those where you don't want to put it down because you don't want to say goodbye to them.
Sounds great really for the fun. Summer. Three Generations of Women in the Mosquito Hours by Melissa DeLorenzo. We'll take that recommendation, Rebecca. Thanks for that one. Let me get another here. Alabama, Equality, Alabama, no less. Andy is calling. Hi, Andy, you're on.
Well, I just finished devouring the Kraken Project.
Okay.
By Douglas Preston.
Kraken as in great squid, octopus, what is that? Or something
well,
else?
Well, actually, it's about a software program designed to run a raft on a moon of Titan, which I think is a moon of Saturn, which I think is called Kraken.
Okay, that sounds very cool. So a raft landed on a moon of Saturn and controlled from Earth or something?
Right. Well, actually controlled by this AI program, but it doesn't want to go out there and die in the frozen waste, and it escapes while still in a testing phase on Earth. And not to give away too many points, it's kind of like HAL meets, I don't know, but it's like if HAL escaped into the Internet and how it could develop from there.
Wow. We've got AI on a raft on a moon of Jupiter. That sounds full of promise, Andy. The Kraken Project by Douglas Preston. I appreciate that. Thank you for that. Jane in Montpelier, Vermont. Jane, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hello. What do you recommend?
Florence Harding. It's a biography. It was published in 1998, but I think people can still find it, and it is fascinating.
Tell us why.
Well, because she was the first First Lady to do everything.
But this was Florence was the First Lady of Warren Harding. Calvin Coolidge succeeded her husband.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I got interested in her because I'm a docent at the Vermont State House. And Calvin Coolidge, our man,
sure,
followed Warren Harding after President Harding died. And so I wanted to know, well, who was this President Harding? And I found this fabulous book about her. She was incredible. And anybody interested in our Hillary should read this book, because this is a book about how a woman should have been president.
Florence Harding by Carl Anthony. Jane in Montpelier, Vermont, Calvin Coolidge territory, thank you for that recommendation. Let's get one more. Sarah, Charleston, South Carolina. Sarah, what do you recommend?
The book that I read was Summit by Harry Farthing. And it's an adventure and kind of historical novel as well. It's basically, the plot is about this mountain climber who's trying to get the youngest kid on record up to the top of Mount Everest. And it all goes wrong, but he ends up finding this old artifact on the climb, and it links to a World War II story that he ends up researching and finding out. So it's two stories that are intertwined, one about this mountain climber pre-World War II trying to get to the top of Everest for the Nazis, and then this guy who's involved in all these problems on Everest in present day. And I read it after all the news stories were on about the Sherpas that died in April on Everest.
I tell you, summer reading can go anywhere. Papua New Guinea and Omaha, moons of Saturn, the sides of Everest there. Sarah, thank you very much for that. Maggie, you've got Orfeo on your list from Richard Power. Tell us about this one.
I do. This is a book. It came out at the very beginning of the year, but it ended up on my summer list because I just thought it was beautiful. He's written many books. You might know from the title Orfeo. I think it's a reference to Orpheus. It's about a musician, a composer who has retired and has a quiet little life, who also dabbles in chemistry. He's the kind of composer who writes songs that three people come to hear, kind of dissonant, difficult contemporary music. But he starts ordering DNA online, and he is messing around with chemicals and compounds and trying to feed them into musical composition, like coding in a way. Of course, the Joint Security Task Force finds out. And so it's like a beautiful lyrical book about music and also, you know, the Joint Security Task Force is part of the book. And he goes on a road trip. He's fleeing the government. And in this flight away from his life, they're worried about what he's doing in his house, with all these chemicals. He looks back on his life as Orpheus tragically did. It's a book about kind of being an artist, I think. It's a book about looking back on your life and the intense desire to have what you make and think and feel about shared by other people. So it's kind of crazy. It's a road trip book, but it's also a beautifully written lyrical book about music and what it feels like in words to listen to music.
I'm a little happily slack-jawed there for a summer nomination. Chemicals, Music, and the Joint Task Force, What It Means to Be an Artist. I love that. Talk about Get Away for the Summer. That's pretty great. We just got a second here, Power World, The Fever, Teenage Girls. What? We just got 20 seconds. This is from Megan Abbott.
You need to have one thriller. You need to have one mystery book. And if you loved Gillian Flynn stuff, this is a book about a group of very, very strange teenage girls who seem to be suffering from an epidemic of seizures that nobody can explain.
Razor-sharp treachery, jealousy, hormones, and insecurities of teenage girls. If you haven't had enough of that, have another round this summer. What fun this has been. You've all three taken us all over the place in more ways than one, and we're grateful for it. Parul Sehgal at the New York Times Book Review, book editor there. Thank you so much for joining us, Parul. Have a great summer.
Thank you so much.
Maggie Galehouse at the Houston Chronicle. Thanks for your suggestions, Maggie.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
And Paul Ingram at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for your recommendations.
Thank you, Tom. It was great.
Listeners, happy reading all summer long. It's all at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point.